To the Queen Tower. It was Lintley. Knights of the Body, all swords to the Queen. They had been seen, and too early. Eadh ran to the window and looked down. With her razor senses, she could see every fine detail of the clash. In the Sundial Garden, Crest retainers were locking swords with the armed Knights of the Body. She saw Loth, sword flashing in his hand. Margaret stood back to back with him. The flame called for release. For the first time since she was a child, Eadh conjured a fistful of draconic fire, red as the morning sun, and hurled it at the Sundial Garden, into the midst of the traitors. Panic reigned. The retainers turned wildly, searching for the source of fire, no doubt thinking a worm was above. Seizing the moment, Loth struck down his adversary with his elbow. Eadh saw his face harden, his throat flex, and his fist clench. "People of the court," he called, "hearken to me." The commotion had already roused the palace. Windows were opening in every building. "I am Lord Arteloth Beck, who was banished from Innes for loyalty to the crown." Loth strode to the middle of the Sundial Garden as he bellowed over the clangor of blades. "Igraine Crest has turned against our queen. She allows her retainers to wear her colours and carry arms. She spits at the Knight of Fellowship by allowing her servants to fight like hounds at court. These are traitorous actions." He sounded like a man reborn. "I urge you, in fellowship and faith, to rise for Her Majesty," he shouted. "Help us reach the Queen Tower and assure her safety." Cries of outrage ascended from the windows. "You, what are you doing in here?" Eadh turned. 12 more retainers had appeared. "It's her," one of them barked, and they ran towards her. "Eadh Durian, yield your weapons." She could not handle all of them. Blood it would have to be. 2 swords were already in her hands. She leapt high and landed, cat-like in their midst, slicing fingers and tendons, spilling guts like a cup purse spilling gold. Death came for them like a desert wind. Her blades were as red as the cloak she had forsworn, and when the dead lay at her feet, she looked up, tasting iron, hands gloved in wetness. Lady Igraine Crest stood at the end of the corridor, flanked by 2 knights-errant. "Enough, Your Grace," Eadh sheathed her blades. "Enough." Crest appeared unruffled by the carnage. "Mistress Durian," she said, eyebrow raised. "Blood, my dear, is never the way forward." "Rich words," Eadh replied, "from one whose hands are soaked in it." Crest did not flinch. "How long have you seen yourself as the judge of queens?" Eadh took a step towards her. "How long have you been punishing them for straying from whichever path you deemed virtuous?"
"You are raving, Mistress Durian.
Murder is against the teachings of your ancestor, and yet you judged the Barethneth and found them wanting. Queen Rosarian took her lover outside the marriage bed, and in your eyes she was stained." He had paused. "Rosarian is dead because of you." It was an arrow loosed into the dark, aimed on little more than instinct, and yet Crest smiled, and Eadh knew. "Queen Rosarian," the Duchess of Justice said, "was removed by Sigoso Vitalda. With your approval, your help from inside. He was a scapegoat and weapon, but you were the instigator," Eadh said. "I suppose when it all went smoothly, you understood your power. You hoped to mould the daughter into a more obedient queen than the mother. Tried to make Sabran dependent on your counsel, and to make her love you as a second mother." She mirrored that little smile. "But of course, Sabran developed a will of her own." "I am the heir of Dame Lorien Crest, the Knight of Justice." Crest spoke in a measured tone. "She who ensured that the great jewel of life was conducted fairly, who weighed the cups of guilt and innocence, who punished the unworthy, and who saw to it that the righteous would triumph always over the sinners. She who was most beloved of the saint, whose legacy I have lived to defend." Her eyes were now afire with fervour. "Sabran Barethnet," she said softly, "has destroyed the house. She is Baronstock, bastard-born, no true heir of Galleon Barethnet. A Crest must wear the crown to glorify the saint."
"The saint would brook no tyrants on the throne of Innes," a voice behind Eadh said.
Sir Tharion Lintley appeared at her shoulder with 9 of the Knights of the Body. They surrounded Crest and her protectors.
"Igraine Crest," Lintley said, "you are arrested on suspicion of high treason. You will come with us to the Durn Tower."
"You cannot make an arrest without a warrant from Her Majesty,"
Crest said, or from myself. She looked straight ahead, as if all of them were beneath her. Who are you to draw your swords upon holy blood? Lintley did not dignify the question with a retort. Go, he said to Eard. Get to Her Majesty. Eard needed no urging. She cast a final look at Crest and made for the end of the corridor.
We can have a peaceful transition now, or war when the truth outs, Crest called after her. And it will, Mistress Durian. The righteous will always triumph, in the end.
Jaw clenched, Eard strode away. As soon as she was out of sight, she broke into a run. Blood dripped in her wake as she followed the path she had taken countless times. Into the presence chamber she ran. All was cold and dark. She rounded a corner, and there were the doors to the great bedchamber, the doors she had walked through so many times to find the Queen of Innis. Something moved in the darkness. Eard stopped short. Her flame cast a queasy light on the figure crumpled by the doors. Eyes like cobalt glass and a curtain of dark hair. Roslane, get back! A knife shone in her grasp.
I will cut your throat if you touch her. Grandmother, I swear it!
It's me, Roslane. Eard.
The chief gentlewoman of the bedchamber finally saw past the light.
Eard! She kept the knife up, breathing hard. I dismissed the rumours about your sorcery, but perhaps you are the Lady of the Woods. A humbler witch than she, I assure you.
Eard crouched beside Roslane and reached for her right hand, making her flinch. Three of her fingers were bent at a grotesque angle, a splinter of bone jutting out above her love-knot ring.
Did your grandmother do this? Eard asked her quietly. Or are you in league with her?
Roslane let out a bitter laugh.
Saint Eard!
You were raised in the shadow of a queen. Perhaps you grew to resent her.
I am not in her shadow. I am her shadow. And that, Roslane bit out, has been my privilege.
Eard studied her, but there was no deceit in that tear-stained face.
Go to her, but be on your guard, Roslane whispered. If my grandmother comes back,
your grandmother is arrested. At this, Roslane let out a breathless sob. Eard squeezed her shoulder. Then she stood. And for the first time in an age, she faced the doors to the great bedchamber. Each sinew of her being was a harp string pulled taut. Inside, the darkness yawned sinister. The flame untethered itself from her hand to float like a ghost light, and by its pallid flicker, Eard made out a figure at the foot of the bed.
Sabran?
The figure stirred.
Leave me, it rasped. I am at prayer.
Eard was already beside Sabran, lifting her head. Shivering limbs recoiled from her.
Sabran, her voice quaked. Sabran, look at me.
When Sabran raised her gaze, Eard drew in a breath. Gaunt and listless, wound in the shroud of her own hair, Sabran Barethnet looked more of a carcass than a queen. Her eyes, once limpid, took little in, and the smell of days unwashed clung to her nightgown.
Eard,
fingers came to her face. Eard pressed her icy hand to her cheek.
No. You are another dream. You come here to torment me.
Sabran turned away.
Leave me in peace.
Eard stared at her. Then she laughed for the first time in weeks, a laugh that stemmed from deep in her belly.
Damn you, intransigent fool! She almost choked on her laughter. I have crossed the south and the west to get back to you, Sabran Barethnet, and you reward me thus?
Sabran looked at her a moment longer, her face clearing, and suddenly began to weep.
Eard,
she said, her voice splintering, and Eard crushed her close, wrapping her arms around as much of her as she could. Sabran curled like a kitten against her. There was nothing of her. Eard pulled the coverlet from the bed and enfolded her in it. Explanations could come later. So could vengeance. For now, all she wanted was for her to be safe and warm.
She killed Trude Utziadur.
Sabran was shivering so badly she could hardly speak.
She imprisoned my knights of the body. Igraine, I tried.
Hush. Eard pressed a kiss to her brow. I am here. Loth is here. Everything will be well.
Chapter 51 East. It was just past dawn, and in the courtyard of Vane Hall, Elder Vara was oiling his iron leg. Tanne approached him. The cold had turned her knuckles pink.
Good morning, Ildavara.
She set down a tray. I thought you might wish to break your fast.
Tane, his smile was weary.
How kind of you. My old bones would be grateful for the warmth.
She sat beside him.
Does it often need oiling? She asked.
Once a day in damp conditions, or rust begins to set in. Eldevara patted the limb. Since the metalsmith who made it for me is now dead, I would sooner not chance losing it.
Tane had grown used to reading his expressions. Since the attack, fear had taken up permanent residence in the Hall of Feather Island, but the worry etched on his face was fresh.
Is something amiss?
Eldevara glanced at her.
The learned Dr. Moyaka wrote to me upon her arrival in Psyche, he said. The High Sea Guard suspects the fleet of the Tiger Eye is holding a dragon hostage. It seems they intend to keep it alive, to guarantee them safe passage through any waters they desire. A sinister new tactic, to hold our gods as leverage.
Tane made herself pour the tea. Hatred closed her throat.
There is a rumor that the Golden Empress seeks the fabled mulberry tree, Eldevara continued, on the lost isle of Komoridu.
Do you know anything else about the dragon? Tane pressed. Do you know its name?
Tane, it grieves me to tell you, but... Eldevara sighed. It is the great Naimathon.
Tane swallowed, throat aching. She is still alive?
If these rumors are true...
Eldevara gently took charge of the kettle.
Dragons do not do well out of water, Tane, as you know. Even if she is alive, the great Naimathon is not long for this world.
Tane had mourned her dragon. Now there was a possibility, however small, that she lived. This news changed everything.
We must hope the High Sea Guard can find a way to free her. I am quite sure they will.
Eldevara passed her a cup.
Please, allow me to change the subject.
Did you come out here to ask me something?
With difficulty, Tane pushed Naimathan to the back of her mind, but her world was spinning.
I was just wondering, she made herself say, if I might request your permission to look in the repository. I would like to read about the celestial jewels.
Eldevara frowned. That is secret knowledge indeed. I thought only the elders knew of it.
The great Naimathan told me.
Ah, he considered. Well, if you desire it, of course. There are scant records of the celestial jewels, which were sometimes called the tide jewels or wishing jewels, but you may examine what little there is.
He motioned to the north.
You will need documents from the reign of the long-honored Empress Mokwo, which are stored at Windward Hall. I will send you with a letter to grant you access.
Thank you, Eldevara.
Tane dressed warmly for the journey. A padded coat over her uniform, a wrap around her head and face, and the fur-lined boots she had been given for winter.
Along with a scroll addressed to the High Scholar of Windward Hall, Eldevara also gave her a satchel of food. It would be a long trek, especially in the cold. She would have to climb down to the path of the Elder, scale the rocks on the other side, and walk the warmth of Windward Hall. Tufts of snow began to fall as she set off. The only way down from this side was to use the craggy rocks beside the Falls of Quirikki. As she descended, her heart thumped so hard she felt sick. At this very moment, Naimathan might be fighting for her life in the belly of a butcher ship. And surely a celestial jewel, if that was what had been stitched into Tane, like a pattern into cloth, surely that could set a dragon free. It was almost noon by the time she reached the foot of the ravine, where a driftwood gateway marked the entrance to the most sacred place in the east. Tane washed her hands in the salt water and stepped through, onto a stone-paved path. On the path of the Elder, the fog was so thick that it blotted out the sky. Tane could not even see the tops of the cedars that towered into the grey. It was not quite silent. Every few moments the leaves rustled as if unsettled by breath. Lanterns guided her past the graves of scholars, elders, and leaders of the dragon-fearing East, who had asked for their remains to rest with those of the great Elder. Some of the stone blocks were so old that the inscriptions had worn away, leaving their occupants unnamed. Eldevara had told her not to think of the past. Walking here, however, she could not help but think of Susa. The bodies of the executed were left to rot, the bones discarded. A head in a ditch, a body uncorked, darkness stained the edges of her vision. It took much of the day to cross the burial ground and climb the rock face at its end. By the time she glimpsed Cape Quill, the outstretched arm of the island, the sky had deepened to purple, and the only light was a gold seam on the horizon. Date plums hung like tiny suns in the front courtyard of Wynwood Hall, which overlooked the Cape. Tane was greeted at the threshold by a lacustrine man with a shaven head, proclaiming his role as a bone singer. These scholars would spend most of their days on the path of the elder, tending to the graves of the faithful and singing praise to the bones of the great Quirky.
"Honorable scholar," he bowed, and so did Tane, "welcome to Wynwood Hall."
"Thank you, learned bone singer." She removed her boots and stowed them. The bone singer ushered her into the dimly lit interior of the hermitage, where a charcoal stove kept the cold at bay.
"Now," he said, "what may we do for you?"
"I have a message from the learned Elder Vara," she held it out. "He asks that you permit me to access your repository." With raised eyebrows, the young man took it.
"We must respect the wishes of the learned Elder Vara," he said, "but you must be tired after your journey. Would you like to visit the repository now or wait in the guest quarters until morning?"
"Now," Tane said, "if you would be willing to take me."
To our knowledge, Feather Island was the only place in the East to remain untouched during the Great Sorrow, the bone singer told her as they walked. "Many ancient documents have been sent here to protect them from misfortune. Unfortunately, since the fire breathers have woken and discovered our whereabouts, those documents are now in danger."
"Were any lost in the attack?"
"A handful," he said. "We organize our archives by reigns. Do you know whose you seek?"
"The long-honored Empress Mokwo."
"Ah, yes, a mysterious figure. It was said she had ambitions to bring the whole East under the rule of the Rainbow Throne. That her face was so lovely that every butterfly wept in envy."
His smile dimpled his cheeks.
"When history fails to shed light on the truth, myth creates its own."
Tane followed him down a staircase, into a tunnel. The wheel repository stood like a sentinel in a cave behind the hermitage. Statues of past high scholars filled alcoves in the walls, and countless teardrops of blue light hung, like wisps of spider silk, from the ceiling.
"We do not risk flame down here," the bone singer said. "Fortunately, the cave has its own lamps."
Tane was fascinated. "What are they?"
"Moondrops, eggs of the light fly."
He turned the repository.
"All of our documents are treated with oil of dragon mane here and left to dry out in the ice caves. Scholar Ishari was oil-treating some of our newest additions to the repository when the fire breathers came."
"Scholar Ishari?" Tane echoed. Her stomach knotted. "Is she in the hermitage?"
"Sadly, the learned scholar was injured in the attack while trying to save the documents. She died of her pains."
He spoke of death the way only bone singers could, with acceptance and quietude. Tane swallowed the ash of regret. Ishari had taken but 19 years, and most of them had been spent preparing for a life she had never been given a chance to lead. The bone singer opened a door to the repository.
"The documents here pertain to the reign of the long-honored Empress Mokwo."
There were not many.
"I would ask you to handle them as little as possible. Come back inside whenever you please."
"Thank you." He bowed and left her. In the calm blue glow, Tane took stock of the scrolls. By the flicker of the moondrops, she unraveled the first scroll and began to read, trying hard not to think of Ishari. It was a letter from a diplomat in the City of the Thousand Flowers. Tane was fluent in lacustrine, but this was an ancient clerical script. Translating it made her temples ache.
"We here address Neporo, self-declared Queen of Komerudu, whose name we hear for the first time, to thank you for sending an embassy with tribute. Though we welcome your deference, your unexpected claim to a land in the unending sea has caused some insult to our neighbor Psyche, with whose people we are bound in praise of dragonkind. We regret that we cannot recognize you as Queen Regnant while the House of Noisaken takes issue with the matter. We confer upon you instead the title Lady of Komeridu, Friend of the Lacustrine. We expect you to rule your people in peace and to endeavor to be devoted and obedient to both ourselves and to Psyche."
Komeridu? Tane had never heard of such a place. Neither had she heard of any ruler named Neporo. She opened another scroll. This letter was in archaic Psychanese, the writing cramped and smeared, but she could just make it out. It seemed to be addressed to the long-honored Nozeken Mokwo herself.
Majesty, I address you once again. Neporo is in mourning for her friend. The sorceress from across the sea is dead. It was the two of them who, using the two objects I described in my last missive, the waning jewel and the rising jewel, caused the great chaos in the abyss on the third day of spring. The body of the Lassian sorceress will now be returned to her country, and Neporo bids 12 of her subjects escort it, along with the white jewel the sorceress often wore at her breast. Since His Augustness, the great Quiriki in his mercy, has arranged us this opportunity, I will endeavor to do as you command.
The other documents were all court records. Tare scoured them until the line between her eyebrows felt etched there with a knife. She almost fell asleep in the glow of the cave, going over every document again, searching for anything she might have missed, checking her translations. Heavy-eyed, she eventually stumbled to the guest quarters, where a meal and a sleep robe had been left for her. She lay on the bedding for a long while, staring into the dark. It was time to uncover what she had hidden, to unlock whatever power lay inside it. The great chaos in the abyss. But what chaos? And why?
Chapter 52. West.
If one of you does not speak, the Queen of Innis said, we shall be here for a very long time.
Loth exchanged a glance with Eard. She was sitting on the other side of the table, wearing an ivory shirt and breeches, her hair half pulled back from her face. They were in the council chamber at the top of the alabastrine tower. Buttered light shone through the windows. With only a little help to bathe and dress, the queen had stitched herself back together with as much metal as any warrior. Freeing Sobran had been the first victory of the night. The news that the Duchess of Justice had been arrested for high treason had caused most of her retainers to give up their arms. The Knights of the Body, with the help of the palace guards, had worked until the dawn to root out the last of the traitors and to stop them fleeing the palace. Nelda Stillwater, Lemon Finch, and the Nighthawk had arrived at court not long after, each with an affinity of retainers in tow. They had claimed to be coming to liberate the queen from Crest, but Sobran had ordered them all locked away until she could unravel the truth. Eard had pieced together what had happened. On the night she had been forced to leave Innis, Sobran had grown feverish. She had appeared to recover a few days later, only to collapse. Crest had ostensibly taken control of her care, but for weeks, behind the doors of the great bedchamber, she had pressed her queen to sign a document called the Oath of Relinquishment. Her signature on it would yield the throne of Innis to the Crest family from the drying of the ink until the end of time. Crest had threatened her with exposure of her barrenness, or death, if she refused. Sobran had remained defiant, even while she was too weak to feed herself, even when Crest had shut her up in darkness.
"I see I will not need to bring anyone to pry out your tongues," Sobran said. "You appear to have swallowed them."
Eard was nursing a cup of ale. This was the first time in hours that she had been more than a foot away from Sobran.
"Where should we begin?" she said evenly.
"You can begin, Mistress Durian, by confessing who you are. They told me you were a witch," Sobran said, "that you had abandoned my court to pledge to the Flesh King. And you believed this nonsense. I had no idea what to believe. Now, when you return to me, you are drenched in blood and have left a pile of bodies higher than a horse behind you. You are no lady in waiting."
Eard rubbed her temple with one finger. Finally, she looked Sobran full in the face.
"My name," she said, "is Eardaz Duzala Uknara." Though her voice was steady, her eyes betrayed an inner conflict. "And I was brought to you by Chasa Uk Ispad as a bodyguard."
"And what made His Excellency believe that you were better placed to protect me than my Knights of the Body?"
"I am a mage, a practitioner of a branch of magic called Sidon. Its source is the same orange tree in Lassia that protected Clearlind Ogenu when she vanquished the Nameless One."
"An enchanted orange tree," Sobran let out a huff of laughter.
"Next you will tell me pears can sing.
Does the Queen of Innis mock what she does not understand?"
Loth glanced from one to the other. Eard had seldom talked to Sobran at all when he had last been at court. Now, it seemed, she could goad the sovereign with impunity.
"Lord Arteloth," Sobran said, "perhaps you can enlighten me as to how you came to leave the court.
And how you met with Mistress Durian on your journey. It seems she is all addle-brained. Eid snorted into her cup. Loth reached across the table and poured from the jug of ale.
Lord Satan Combe sent Kit and myself to Cascaro. He believed I was an impediment to your marriage prospects, he said. In the Palace of Salvation, we met the Domata Morosa, who had a task for us. And from there, I'm afraid things only wax stranger. He told her everything. The Flesh King's confession that he had arranged to murder her mother, the mysterious cupbearer whose hands were also bloody in that deed. He told her of Kit's death, and the iron box he had taken across the desert, of his imprisonment in the priory, and the daring escape back to Innis on the Bird of Truth. Ead chimed in, here and there. She enriched and broadened the story, telling Sabran about her banishment and her visit to the ruined city of Gulfaga, about the long-haired star and the tablet of Rumalabar. She went into great depth about the foundation of the Priory of the Orange Tree and its beliefs, and the reason she had been sent back to Innis. Sabran did not move once as she listened. Only the flicker of her gaze betrayed her thoughts about each revelation. If Sabran the First was not born of Clearland, she said eventually, and I am not saying I believe it, Ead, then who was her mother? Who was the first queen of Innis?
I don't know. Sabran raised her eyebrows.
While I was in Lassia, I learned more about the Tablet of Rumalabar, Ead continued. To understand its mystery, I paid a visit to Kaliba, the witch of Iniska.
She glanced at Loth. She is known here as the Lady of the Woods. She created Ascalon for Galleon Barethnet. Ead had not mentioned this on the ship.
The Lady of the Woods is real, Loth asked. She is?
He swallowed.
And you claim she made the true sword, Sabran said. The terror of the Haithwood.
The very same, Ead said, undaunted.
Ascalon was forged with both Sidon and Sidereal magic, Sterin, which comes from a substance left behind a long-haired star. It was these two branches of the power that the Tablet of Rumalabar describes. When one waxes, the other wanes.
Sabran was wearing the same mask of indifference she often wore in the presence chamber.
To recapitulate, she said tautly, you believe my ancestor, the blessed saint, was a power-hungry, lustful craven who tried to press a country into accepting his religion, wielding a sword granted to him by a witch, and never defeated the Nameless One. And stole the recognition for the latter from Princess Clearland, yes. You think I am the seed of such a man.
Fair roses have grown from twisted seeds.
What you did for me does not give you the right to blaspheme in my presence. So you would like your new virtuous counsel to tell you only what you want to hear.
Ead raised her cup.
Very well, Your Majesty. Loth can be Duke of Flattery, I'll be Duchess of Deceit. Enough,
Sabran barked.
Peace,
Loth cut in. Please. Neither of them spoke.
We cannot quarrel. We must be united now, because of...
His mouth was dry.
Because of what is to come.
And what is to come. Loth tried to say it, but the words fled from him. He gave Ead a defeated look.
Sabran, Ead said quietly, the Nameless One will return. For a long time, Sabran seemed to withdraw into her own world. Slowly, she rose, walked towards the balcony, and stood upon it, limned by the sun.
It is true, Ead said eventually. A letter to the priory from a woman named Naporo convinced me. Clearland stood with her to bind the Nameless One, but only for 1,000 years. And that 1,000 years is very close to ending.
Sabran placed her hand on the balustrade. A breeze caught a few strands of her hair.
So, she said, it is as my ancestor said, that when the House of Barethnet ends, the Nameless One will return. It has not to do with you, Ead said, or your ancestors. Most likely, Galleon made the claim to consolidate his newfound power and to make himself a god in the eyes of his people. He fed his descendants to the jaws of his lie.
Sabran said nothing. Loth wanted to comfort her, but nothing could soften tidings like these.
The Nameless One was bound on the 3rd day of spring, during the 20th year of the reign of Makwo, Empress of Psyche, he had said. But I do not know when Makwo ruled. You must ask High Princess Ermuna to find the date. She is Archduchess of Ostendir, where documents on the east are stored.
When Sabran continued in her silence, Ead sighed.
I know this is heresy to you, But if you love the woman you know as the damsel, if you have any respect for the memory of Clearlind Agenu, then you will do this. Sobran lifted her chin. And if we discover the date, what then? Eid reached under her collar and withdrew the pale jewel she had taken from the priory. This is the waning jewel. It is one of a pair. She placed it on the table. It is made from Sterin. Its sister is most likely in the east. The letter said we need them both. Sobran looked at it over her shoulder. The sunshine glowed in the waning jewel. Being close to it gave Loth a sense of cool tranquility, almost the opposite of what he always felt from Eid. She was the living flame of the sun. This was starlight. After Clearlind wounded the Nameless One, she appears to have travelled to the east, Eid said. There she met Naporo of Kamaridu, and together they bound the Nameless One in the abyss. She tapped the jewel. We must repeat what was done 1,000 years ago, but we must finish it this time. And to do that, we also need Ascalon. Sobran returned her gaze to the horizon. Every Berethnet queen has searched for the true sword, to no avail. None of them had a jewel that would call to it. Eid hung it around her neck again. Kaliba told me that Galleon meant to leave Ascalon in the hands of those who would die to keep it hidden. We know he had a loyal retinue, but does anyone come to mind? Edric of Arendene, Loth said at once. The saint squired for him before he became a knight himself, viewed him as a father. Where did he live? Loth smiled. As a matter of fact, he said, he is one of the founders of the Beck family. Eid raised her eyebrows. Goldenbirch, she said. Perhaps I will begin my search there, with you and Meg, if you will keep me company. Your father has been wanting to speak to her, in any case. You truly think it could be in Goldenbirch? It is as good a place as any to begin. Loth thought of the night before. One of us should stay, he said. Meg can go with you. At last, Sobran turned to face them again. Whether this legend is true or not, she said, I have no choice but to trust you, Eid. Her face hardened. Our mutual enemy will rise. Both our religions confirm it. I mean for us to stand against him. I mean to lead Innis to victory, as Glorian Shieldheart did. I believe you can, Eid said. Sobran returned to her seat. Since there are no ships heading north tonight, she said, I would like you to attend the Feast of High Winter. You too, Loth. Loth frowned. The feast will still proceed. I think there is more need for it than ever. The arrangements ought to be in place. People will see that you are not with child, Loth hesitated. Will you tell them you are barren? Sobran dropped her gaze to her belly. Barren. A thin smile. We must think of a different word for it, I think. That one makes me sound like a field stripped of its crop, a waste with nothing left to give. She was right. It was a cruel way to describe a person. Forgive me, he murmured. Sobran nodded. I will tell the High Court that I lost a child, but as far as they will know, I might yet conceive another. It would grieve her subjects, but leave them with a ray of hope. Eid, Sobran said, I would like to make you a member of the Knight's Bachelor. I want no titles. You will accept, or you will be in too much danger to remain at court. Crest told everyone you were a witch. This position will dispel any doubt that I believe you loyal. I agree, Loth said. Eid offered the barest nod of acknowledgement. Dear I am, then, she said, after a pause. The silence yawned long between the three of them. Allies now, yet they seemed to sit on a glass in that moment. A glass broken into fault lines of religion and inheritance. I will go and tell Margaret of our journey, Eid said, and rose. Oh, and Sobran, I will not be wearing court fashions any longer. I've had more than enough of trying to protect you in a petticoat. She left without waiting to be dismissed. Sobran looked after her with a strange expression. Are you well? Loth said to her quietly. Now you are back. They both smiled, and Sobran covered his hand with hers. Cold as always, the nails tinged with lilac. He had teased her about it when they were children. Princess Snow. I have not yet thanked you for all you did to liberate me, she said. I understand you were the one who roused the court in my defense. He squeezed her hand. You are my queen and my friend. When I heard that you had left, I thought I would go mad. I knew you would never have gone on your own accord, but I had no proof. I was powerless in my own court. I know.
She pressed his hand once more. For now, she said, I am entrusting to you the duties of the Duchy of Justice. You will decide whether Combe, Finch, and Stillwater truly were returning to help me.
This is a grave obligation, meant for one with holy blood, Loth said. Surely one of the Earl's provincial proper would be better.
I trust it only to you. Sobran pushed a sheet of parchment across the table. Here is the oath of relinquishment pressed upon me by Crest. With my signature, this document would have yielded the throne to her family. Loth read it. His throat dried out as he took in the wax seal, impressed with twin goblets. The fever and pain made me too weak to understand a great deal of what was happening to me. I was focused on surviving, Sobran said. Once, however, I heard Crest arguing with Rosalaine, saying that the oath of relinquishment would make her queen some day, and her daughter after that, and that she was an ingrate for resisting. And Ros? Ros said she would die before she took the throne from me. Loth smiled. He would have expected nothing less from Rosalaine. The night before you arrived, Sobran continued, I woke unable to breathe. Crest had a pillow over my face. She kept whispering that I was unworthy, like my mother before me, that the line was poisoned, that even Berethnet must answer to the call of justice. Her hand ghosted to her mouth. Ros broke her fingers, prying her off me. So much suffering, all for naught. Crest must die, Sobran concluded. For their failure to act against her, I will have Ella and Withy confined to their castles to await my pleasure. I will strip them of their duchies in favour of their heirs. Her face closed. I tell you this, holy blood or not, I will see Crest burn for what she has done. Once, Loth would have protested such a brutal punishment, but Crest deserved no pity. For a time, I almost believed I should yield the throne, that Crest wanted the best for the realm. Sobran lifted her chin. But we must be united in the face of the draconic threat. I will cleave to my throne, and we will see what comes of it. She sounded more a queen than ever. Loth, she added quieter, you were with Eärd in this Priory of the Orange Tree. You have seen the truth of her, she held his gaze. Do you still trust her? Loth poured a little more ale for them both. The Priory made me question the foundations of our world, he admitted, but throughout it all, I trusted Eärd. She saved my life, at great risk to her own. He handed her a cup. She wants to keep you alive, Sab. I believe she wants it more than anything. Something changed in her face. I must write to Amuna. Your chamber awaits you, she said, but be sure not to be late for the feast. When she looked up at him, he saw a glint of the old Sobran in her eyes. Welcome back to court, Lord Arteloff. On the highest floor of the Dern Tower, in the cell where Trude Utziadur had spent her final days, Igraine Crest was at prayer. Only an arrow slit cast light into her prison. When Loth entered, she did not raise her lowered head, nor unclasp her hands. Lady Igraine, Loth said. She was still. If it please you, I have come to ask you some questions.
I will answer for what I have done, Crest said, only in Halgallant.
You will not see the Heavenly Court, Loth said quietly. So let us begin here.
Chapter 53 West. The Feast of High Winter began at 6 o'clock in the banqueting house of Ascalon Palace. As always, it would be followed by music and dancing in the presence chamber. As the bells chimed in the clock tower, Eärd studied her reflection. Her gown was palest blue silk, snowed with seed pearls, the ruff made of white cutwork lace. For one more night, she would dress as a courtier. Her sisters would think her even more of a traitor when they discovered that she had accepted a title from the Queen of Innis. If she was to survive here, however, it seemed she had no other choice. A knock at the door, and Margaret let herself in. She wore ivory satin and a silver girdle, and her atifet was studded with moonstones. "I just came from Sobran," she said. "I am to be made a lady of the bedchamber." She set down the candle. "I thought you might not want to go to the banqueting house alone." "You thought correctly, as always." Eärd met her gaze in the glass. "Meg, what has Loth told you about me?"
"Everything." Margaret grasped her by the shoulders. "You know I take the Knight of Courage as my patron. There is courage, I think, in open-mindedness and thinking for oneself. If you are a witch, then perhaps witches are not so wicked after all.
Her face turned serious. Now, a question. Would you prefer me to call you Eadaz?
No, but thank you for asking. Ead was touched.
You may call me Ead, as I call you Meg. Very well.
Margaret linked her arm.
Then let me reintroduce you to Cor, Ead.
Snow had settled thickly on every ledge and step. Courtiers were emerging from all over the palace, drawn to the light from the windows of the banqueting house. As they entered, the steward called out,
Lady Margaret Beck and Mistress Ead Durian,
her old name, her false name. The banqueting house fell almost silent. Hundreds of eyes turned to look upon the witch. Margaret tightened her grip on her arm. Loth was alone at the high table, seated to the left of the throne. He beckoned with one hand. They walked between the rows of tables. When Margaret went to the chair on the other side of the throne, Ead sat beside her. She had never once eaten at the high table, which had always been reserved for the queen, the duke spiritual, and two other guests of honour. In the old days, those guests of honour had usually been Loth and Roslane.
I've seen more cheer in a charnel garden, Margaret muttered. Did you speak to Roslane, Loth?
Loth rested his knuckles on his cheek and turned his face towards them, hiding his lips.
Aye, he said, after the bonesetter came to send her hand.
He kept his voice low. It appears your instinct was right, Ead. Cress believes herself to be the judge of queens. Ead took no pleasure in it.
I am not sure when her madness set in, Loth went on, but when Queen Rosarion was alive, one of her ladies reported to Cress that she had taken Captain Gian Harlow as a lover. Cress saw Rosarion as a harlot, unfit to be queen. She punished her in several ways, then decided that she was beyond reform.
Ead could see in his face that he was struggling to swallow this. He had believed for too long in the delicate artifice of court. Now the artfully placed leaves had blown away, revealing the shining jaws of the trap.
She warned Queen Rosarion, Loth continued, brow pinched, but the affair with Harlow carried on.
He glanced towards the door.
Even after Sab was born.
Margaret raised her eyebrows.
So Sabran may be his daughter?
If Cress speaks true.
And I think she does.
Once she started talking, she seemed almost desperate to tell me every detail of her enterprise.
Another secret to be kept. Another crack in the marble throne.
Once Sab was old enough to bear children of her own, Loth said, Cress sought help from King Sagoso. She knew he reviled Rosarion for refusing his hand, so together they conspired to kill her, with Cress hoping the blame would drift towards Iskallen.
And Cress still considered herself pious, Margaret snorted, after murdering a Berethnet.
Piety can turn the power-hungry into monsters, Ead said. They can twist any teachings to justify their actions. She had seen it before. Meeta had believed she was serving the mother when she executed Zala.
Cress waited then, Loth said, waited to see if Sabran would grow to be more devout than her mother.
When Sab resisted the childbed, Cress sensed rebellion. She bribed people to enter the Queen Tower with blades to frighten her.
Ead, it is just as you suspected. The cutthroats were supposed to be caught. Crest promised their families they would be compensated.
And she infiltrated Trude's plan in order to kill the Evelyn? Margaret asked, and Loth nodded.
But why?
The Evelyn traded with Psyche. That was the reason she gave me. She also considered him a drain on Innes, but in truth, I think she could not bear that Sabran spurned her choice of companion. That she was becoming influenced by someone other than her.
Sab did seem hearken to Lievelin, Margaret conceded. She went outside her palace for the first time in 14 years because he asked it of her.
Just so, an upstart sinner with too much power. Once he had served his purpose and Sabran was pregnant, he had to die. Loth shook his head. When the physician told her Sabran would not conceive again, it proved to Crest, once and for all, that she was of tainted seed, and that the House of Berethnet was no longer fit to serve the saint. She decided that the throne must pass, at last, to the only worthy descendants of the holy retinue, to her own heir.
This confession must be enough to condemn Crest, Ead said.
Loth looked grimly satisfied. I do believe it is.
At that moment, the steward thumped his staff on the floorboards.
Her Majesty, Queen Sabran!
The court fell silent as it rose. When Sabran came into the candlelight, with the silver-clad knights of the body behind her, there was a shared intake of breath. Eard had never seen her look so splendidly alone. Usually she came to the banqueting hall with her ladies, or with Satan Comb, or some other person of importance. She wore no powder on her face, no jewellery but her coronation ring. Her gown was black velvet, its sleeves and forepart mourning grey. It was clear to anyone with sense that she was not with child. Murmurs of confusion rang through the hall. It was traditional for a queen to be holding her swaddled daughter the first time she appeared in public after her confinement. Loth stood to let Sabran take the throne. She lowered herself into it, watched by her court. "Mistress Lydon," she said, her voice stentorian, "will you not sing for us?" The knights of the body took their places behind the high table. Lintley never removed his hand from his sword. The court musicians began to play, and Gillett Lydon sang. Silver platters of food were brought out from the great kitchen and laid on the tables, displaying all Innes had to offer in the high winter. Swan pie, woodcock and roasted goose, baked venison in rich clove sauce, burbot sprinkled with almond snowflakes and silver leaf, white cabbage and honey-glazed parsnips, mussels seethed in butter and red wine vinegar. Conversation stole back into the hall, but nobody seemed able to tear their eyes from the queen. A page filled their goblets with ice wine from Hroth. Eard accepted a few mussels and a cut of goose. As she ate, she gave Sabran a sidelong glance. She recognized the look on her face, fragility with a front of strength. As Sabran lifted her goblet to her lips, only Eard noticed the tremor in her hand. Jumbles, sugar plums, spiced pear and cranberry pie, pastry horns stuffed with snow cream, and blanched apple tarts, among other delicacies, followed the main course. When Sabran rose and the steward announced her, a deathly silence fell again. Sabran did not speak for some time. She stood tall, with her hands clasped at her midriff. "Good people," she said at last, "we know that things at court have been disquieting in recent days, and that our absence must have troubled you." Somehow, despite the low pitch of her voice, she managed to make herself heard. "Certain people at this court have conspired of late to break the spirit of fellowship that has always united the people of Virtudom." Her face was a locked door. The court waited for revelation. "It will be a great shock to you that during our recent illness we were confined in the Queen Tower by one of our own councillors who was attempting to usurp our saint-given authority." Murmurs flickered across the hall. "This counsellor took advantage of our absence to pursue her own ambition to steal our throne, a person of holy blood." Eard felt the words in her core, and she knew that everyone else did too. They struck like a wave, left no one untouched. "Because of her actions, we must bring you most grievous news." Sabran placed a hand on her belly. "That during our ordeal, we lost the beloved daughter we carried." The silence went on, and on. And on. Then one of the maids of honour let out a sob, and it was like a thunderclap. The banqueting house erupted around her. Sabran remained still and expressionless. The hall resounded with calls for the perpetrators to pay. The steward banged his staff, shouting to no avail for order, until Sabran raised a hand. At once, the turmoil ceased. "These are uncertain times," Sabran said, "and we cannot afford to give way to grief. A shadow has fallen over our realm. More draconic creatures are waking, and their wings have brought a wind of fear. We see that fear in all your faces. We have seen it, even in our own." Eard watched the crowd. The words were reaching them. By offering them a glimpse of vulnerability, a fine crack in her armour, Sabran showed that she stood among them. "But it is in such times that we must look more than ever to the saint to guide us," Sabran said. "He opens his arms to the fearful. He sheltered us with his own shield, and his love, like a sword in the hand, makes us strong. While we stand together in the great chainmail of Virtudom, we cannot be defeated. We mean to reforge with love what greed has broken. On this, the feast of high winter, we pardon all those who were so quick to serve their mistress that they neglected, in their haste and fear, to serve their queen. They will not be executed. They will know the balm of mercy. But the woman who used them cannot be forgiven. It was her hunger for power, and her wanton abuse of the power she had already been given, that swayed others to her will." The hall flickered with nods. "She has dishonored her holy blood. She has scorned her patron virtue. For Igraine Crest knew no justice in her hypocrisy and malice." The name sent a ripple of unrest along the tables.
By her actions, Crest has shamed not only the Knight of Justice, but the blessed saint and his descendants. Therefore, we expect her to be found guilty of high treason.
Sobran made the sign of the sword, and the court mirrored her.
All of the Duke's spiritual are presently being questioned. It is our fervent hope that the rest are proven innocent, but we shall bow to the evidence.
Each of her words was the skip of a stone across a lake, forming ripples of emotion. The Queen of Innis could not cast illusions, but her voice and bearing on this night had turned her into an enchantress.
We stand here in love, in hope, and in defiance. Defiance of those who would have tried to turn us from our values. Defiance of draconic hate. We rise to face the winds of fear, and by the saint, we will turn them back upon our enemies.
She walked across the dais, and every eye followed her.
We do not yet have an heir, for our daughter is in the arms of the saint, but your queen is very much alive, and we will ride into any battle for you, as Glorian's Shieldheart rode for her people, come what may.
Now there were rumbles of agreement, nods and shouts of, Sobran, queen!
We will prove to the entire world, she continued, that no worm will cow the people of Virtudom.
Virtudom! Voices echoed. Virtudom!
They were all on their feet now, eyes bright in the frenzy of veneration, cups held in taut-knuckled fists. She had led them from the depths of terror to the height of adoration. Sobran was golden-tongued.
Now, in the same defiance this realm has professed for 1,000 years, she called out, we celebrate the feast of high winter and prepare for the spring, the season of change, the season of sweetness, the season of generosity. And what it gives, we will not hoard, but give in turn to you.
She snatched her goblet from the table and thrust it high.
To Virtudom!
Virtudom! The court roared back. Virtudom! Virtudom!
Their voices filled the hall like song, rising to its very rafters. The festivities went on late into the night. Though there were bale fires outside, the courtiers seemed grateful to be in the presence chamber, where Sobran sat on her marble throne, and flames roared in the cavernous hearth. Eid stood with Margaret in the corner. As she sipped her mulled wine, a blaze of red caught her eye. Her hand flicked to the knife on her girdle.
Eid, Margaret touched her elbow.
What is it?
Red hair. The red hair of a Mentish ambassador, not a cloak. Yet, Eid did not relax. Her sisters must be biding their time. But they would come.
Nothing. Forgive me, Eid said.
What were you saying?
Tell me what the matter is.
It is nothing you want to meddle in, Meg.
I wasn't meddling.
Well, perhaps, Margaret admitted.
One must be a trifle meddlesome at court, or no one has nothing to talk about.
Eid smiled. Are you ready for our journey to Goldenbirch tomorrow?
Aye, our ships leave at dawn.
Margaret paused before adding,
Eid, I don't suppose you were able to bring Valor home.
There was hope in her eyes.
He is with an Ursiri family, I trust, on an estate in the Harma Pass, Eid said. I could not take him into the desert. You shall have him back, I promise.
Thank you. Someone stopped beside Margaret and touched her on the shoulder. Catrian Withy, wearing a gown of cloud silk, pearls inlaid in silver nested in her wreath of hair.
Kate! Margaret embraced her. Kate, how do you do?
I have been worse. Catrian kissed her on the cheek before turning to Eid.
Oh, Eid, I'm very glad you're back.
Catrian. Eid looked her over. A bruise was fading under her eye, and her jaw was swollen.
What happened to you?
I tried to get to Sobran. She touched the mark gingerly. Crest had me locked in my quarters. Her guard did this when I resisted.
Margaret shook her head.
If that tyrant had ever sat the throne, thank the damsel she will not.
Sobran, who had been deep in conversation with Loth, now rose, and the room quietened. It was time for her to reward those who had proved most faithful to their queen. The ceremony was no less impressive for its brevity. First, Margaret was formally named a Lady of the Bedchamber, while the Knights of the Body were commended for their ceaseless loyalty to the crown. Others who had joined them were given lands and jewels, and then,
Mistress Eid Durian?
Eid stepped from the crowd. Whispers and looks dogged her footsteps.
By the grace of the six virtues, the steward read, It has pleased Her Majesty to name you Dame Eadaz Uknara, Viscountess Nurtha, a member of the Virtues Council.
The presence chamber rang with murmurs. Viscountess was an honourable title in Innis, used to raise a woman who was not of noble or holy blood. Never had it been bestowed upon one who was not an Innish subject.
Sabran took the ceremonial sword from Loth. Ead held still, as the flat of the blade touched each of her shoulders. This second title would only serve to deepen her treachery in the eyes of her sisters, but she could wear it if it shielded her for long enough to find Ascalon.
"Rise," Sabran said, "my lady."
Ead stood and looked her in the eye.
"Thank you." Her curtsy was brief, "Your Majesty."
She took her letters patent from the steward. People whispered, "My lady," as she returned to Margaret. She was Mistress Durian no more. There was one last honour to be given. For his courage, Sir Tharian Lintley, who was as much a commoner by blood as Eadh, also received a new title. He was made Viscount Morwa.
"Now, Lord Morwa,"
Sabran said in an arch tone, once Lintley had received his accolade, "we believe you are of appropriate rank to marry a daughter of the Earl's Provincial. Pray, do you have anyone in mind?" An outbreak of much-needed laughter followed. Lintley swallowed. He looked like a man who had just been granted all the wishes of his life.
"Yes," he looked across the room. "Yes, Your Majesty, I do. But I would prefer to first speak to the lady in private, to be certain of her heart."
Margaret, who had been watching with pursed lips, raised an eyebrow.
"You have spoken for long enough, Sir Tharian," she called. "Now is the time for action."
More laughter. Lintley chuckled, as did she. Candlelight danced in her eyes. She crossed the room and took his outstretched hand.
"Your Majesty," Lintley said, "I ask your permission and that of the Knight of Fellowship to take this woman as my companion in the coming days."
The way he gazed at her, she might have been a sunrise after years of night,
"so that I might love her as she has always deserved."
Margaret looked to the throne. Her throat bobbed, but Sabran had already inclined her head.
"You have our permission," she said. "We give it gladly."
Cheers filled the presence chamber. Loth, Eadh was pleased to see, clapped as hard as anyone else. "Now," Sabran said, "we think a dance is in order." She motioned to the consort. "Come, play the pavane of the Merrow King." This time, the applause was thunderous. Lintley murmured something to Margaret, who smiled and placed a kiss on his cheek. As the dancers took their places, Loth stepped down from his seat and bowed to Eadh.
"Viscountess," he said, mock somber. "Would you do me the honour of a dance?"
"I shall, my lord." Eadh placed a hand over his, and he led her to the middle of the room.
"How do you like the match?" she asked, seeing him glance towards Margaret.
"Very well. Lintley is a good man." The pavane of the Merrow King was sedate at first. It began like the ocean on a tranquil day, becoming tumultuous as the music swelled. It was an intricate affair, but Eadh and Loth were old hands at it. "My parents will have heard the news by the time you reach Golden Birch," Loth said as they skipped with the other couples.
"Mama will be even more vexed that I am not betrothed myself."
"I think she will be too relieved that you are alive to care," Eadh said. "Besides, you may prefer never to wed."
"As Earl of Golden Birch, it would be expected of me. And I have always longed for companionship."
Loth looked down at her. "But what of you?"
"Me?"
Eadh glided to the right, and he followed.
"Would I ever take a companion, you mean?"
"You cannot go home.
Perhaps you could make a life here, with someone." His gaze was soft.
"Unless you already have."
Her chest tightened. The dance separated them for a moment while they formed a whirlpool with the other pairs. When they reached each other again, Loth said, "Crest told me. I suppose she heard it from the Nighthawk." Saying it out loud would be dangerous. He knew that.
"I hope you did not keep it from me because you thought I would judge you," Loth murmured.
They both turned on the spot.
"You are my dearest friend. I want you to be happy."
"Even though it shames the Knight of Fellowship?"
Eadh raised her eyebrows. "We are not wed."
"I would have believed that before," he admitted. "Now I see that there are more important things."
Eadh smiled.
"You really have changed."
They joined hands again as the pavane grew faster.
"I did not want to burden you with worry for us both. You care too much."
"It is my way," he said.
"But it would be a greater burden to know that my friend felt she could not open her heart to me. He squeezed her hand. I'm here for you, always. And I for you, Iad said. She hoped it could be true. As the pavane came to its end, she wondered if they would ever lie carefree under the apple tree again, sharing wine.